on 1116 SEN. Evenings with Finey. For Alan Mance, don't lose your pants. Call 1-800-ALAN-MANCE. If we're behind, then never mind. We'll fight and win, for we're from
Tigerland. We never weaken till the final. Well, whether it's on the sporting field or in the restaurant game or just about town, the name Dimitina is as Melbourne as Yarra, and probably, given the quality of the food and the quality of the water, a lot more palatable. A heck of a lot more palatable. The man behind the throne, well, the man on the throne, the power behind the Dimitina name, was a very fine league footballer and, of course, has remained synonymous with Melbourne life ever since. I speak of none other than Frank Dimitina, who joins us this very night. Good evening, Frank.
Good evening. How are you, Viney?
I am going well.
And that's the way.
I feel as though talking to Frank Dimitina, I've got to say thank you on about three or four different scores, but maybe when we catch up in person, because...
Well, I'd love to meet you in person, Viney. I've heard so much about you. But anyway, and I know your mate there, Jeff, so very well.
How are you, Frank?
I'm good, Jeff. How are you?
Are you're locked in a three-set... battle with Francis Burke out of his house at the moment?
Yes, we've just come in off the court. Francis was playing brilliantly tonight, and we had Wayne Walsh with us tonight, and Greg Campbell, a champion Geelong man.
Right.
So we've been having a lot of fun on the court, but they've come in now.
And that's and how...
We now have a beer and a few glasses of red.
Right.
And I usually bring a few pizzas over just for the boys to enjoy.
Right.
I mean, they invite me over to bring the pizzas. They don't worry if I come or not.
No, your pizzas are almost as good as your Tasmanian scallops that we used to have at Il Gambero's before it burnt down.
Yeah, that was terrible. Il Gambero burnt down. Of course,
yes.
you had a special
yes.
collaboration with the chef, and he used to give you three serves on the one plate.
That's right. They were crumb Tasmanian scallops. They were little, small ones, not the big ones.
That's right.
Beautiful. I think they came from Spring Bay on the east coast.
You were well known. Right.
Unlike another place where I got them once, and I found out years later they came from Thailand. But all those years, the bloke had told me they were Tasmanian scallops.
Well, you'll have to come back to the new Il Gambero on the park, Jeff.
Yes.
We'll look after you very well. We have a lot of SEN people come in there.
Look forward to it.
Good on you, Jeff. Keep going.
Well, that's right. So there are a couple of things already that Frank Dimitina is particularly famous for, a number of restaurants, as we know, around Melbourne. I guess the flagship is Dimitina's, but Il Gambero, so famous, and Cafe Society, now run wonderfully by his son, Paul.
And the Blue Train Restaurant is another one that
of course.
We've got a big share in, which is a great place for people to go. But, yes, Paul looks after the... he's a little bit more high society than me. I'm just a... He's the restaurateur. I'm just a poor old pizza man, me. So Paul's the true restaurateur in the family. He's the wine connoisseur.
Where did a love of food and a knack for running restaurants come from? I mean, I guess, would love to believe that there's... a mama or a grandmother from the old country, because the food tastes so authentic, one imagines yes. that there is somebody back there.
That's right. Well, we have got... My mother was an outstanding cook, and we always... I think it's the Italian way in hospitality that we love to feed people well and, you know, get together and enjoy, you know, food and drink. It's a way of life, and I think it was natural. And in the... there was a little bit of a... I wasn't a hotel man, and sometimes footballers used to go into hotels, and I went into restaurants. I was actually in the coffee game with... our family was involved in the old days with Mokopan Coffee, and I worked with Mokopan Coffee, so I used to go around and, you know, call on all the restaurants and coffee lounges and pizza bars late at night or whenever. And so I always had a beautiful smelling car full of coffee beans. And that sort of got me knowing a lot of people in the restaurant game. And I thought, gee whiz, I might give this a try. And that's how I got into the game. So all the rest of our family has been, my father was in the fruit and vegetable, my brother was in the fruit and vegetable. So we've been involved in fruit and vegetable, coffee, which my father, with my cousin Joe DiMartino, were one of the first people in Australia to bring out the espresso machines from Italy. So we go back a long way with coffee. And but I was just got into food, and luckily, because when my boys were playing football, battling to get a chance in the game, no one else would employ them, so they used to do part-time work in the restaurant. So that's how we did. That was how the restaurant came. But basically, it started through coffee, and just because of my association with a lot of restaurants. And the partner that I've got involved with, his son has become a chef, and one of my sons has become a chef. So at Ilgumbro on the Park now, the new Ilgumbro, we have two of my nephew and my son, two chefs that work there. So DiMartino's, we've got a fabulous chef as well, but we've got the two family members working at Ilgumbro.
I know that all of that passion for food and that business acumen took a backseat to sport, because Frank DiMartino made his league debut for the Tigers at the very tender age of 17. From De La Salle, almost straight on to the football field. Tell us about what it was like as a raw-boned teenager mixing it with the big and toughest in the league.
Well, I was... it's a terrible story, really, Big Mark. I sort of often say to people, and... I think I'd probably have a record that'll never be... I don't think it's ever happened before, and I don't think it'll ever happen again. My first game, I had... Richmond wanted me to play all that year, but I was at school. I was doing my matriculation in those days, and the brothers said, no, I couldn't play. Couldn't play, you know. So then, at the end of the school football season, Graham Richmond, who was a very persuasive gentleman, come and spoke to the brothers, and he said, well, the football, your school football season's all over. Can Frank come and play with us now? And the brothers said, yes, yes, he can go now. So I played the last five games of the year when I was 17. And in my very first game as a 17-year-old, I played against Bobby Skilton. Okay. And I got 3 Brownlow medal votes in that game. Now, I don't think it's probably, and I'm not sure, it's a very strange one, that, because I didn't know that for a long time, and it's I've tried to check it out, but in the old days, no one knew what game you got votes in or all that sort of thing, but I only played 5 games that year, and that was the game I probably played. I did get in the best players in 2 of the other ones, but we only won that, of the 5 I played, we won that game, and we won the against Fitzroy, which I didn't get in the best players. 2 of the other games I played, I did. But as was told by a couple of experts, you only 95% of players, you only get the 3 votes if you're in the winning side. So the only winning side I played in and was in the best players was against South and against Bobby Skilton in the first game. So I'm 99, and I was told by someone who knows that, yes, you got it in that game. Yeah. So I'm going with that anyway.
Well, it's pretty conclusive.
It's pretty conclusive, yeah. Isn't it?
I think so. Where was that played, Frank?
Hunt Road.
Hunt Road. And did you play directly on? Now, there would have been DiMartino and someone versus Skilton and someone. Did you play on him directly?
I was on Bobby Skilton. I was named first row, and I was on Bobby a lot. I'm just trying to remember the game. I think Peter Hogan was the other rover for Richmond that game.
Yeah.
And I think my memory's not good, but I think Kevin Bartlett comes up this week, is it, for which would have been his first game 50 years ago.
Okay.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yep. Yes.
And I think I was first rover in the Richmond team that day.
Right.
And I think I kicked 3 goals. But I've got a very bad memory because I got knocked out too many times, Jeff, as you remember.
Yes, we'll get on to that one later, Frank. You're a very good friend of Kevin Bartlett because you were his team manager when he coached Richmond years later, weren't you?
Well, he was always guilty because we always say I was the first rover and Kevin was battling to get in. And then all of a sudden he lined up his big Irish mate, Paddy Ganane, to line me up and knock me out. So I got knocked out by my own teammate in front of 90,000 people against Collingwood. And Kevin Bartlett was raised his hands in glee because he was on the bench. And that was in the first 10 minutes of the game. In those days, the 19th or 20th man never got a run until the last 10 minutes, if you were lucky, of the last quarter. But Kevin got on. And as we know, once he got an opportunity, there was no holding him back, and Richmond didn't need another over for another 15 years.
Now, Frank, given that you made your debut in the latter part of 1964...
Yes.
..you would have done so under Len Smith?
I did, yes.
And you also would have experienced with Len Smith's premature departure...
Yes, it was very sad. Len was a lovely, lovely man.
You would have been coached by Jack Skinny Titus.
Jack Skinny Titus, that's right.
With his bow tie on.
Yes.
He would have had his bow tie on, and we just had to be careful not to be in the front row because we would have got spit all over us because, unfortunately, he was a lovely man too, but unfortunately, anyone who was in the front row ended up with spit all over them with Jack Titus.
Apparently, he had a fairly simple approach to coaching. He just extolled the players to get the ball and kick it straight down towards the goals.
That was about it. That was his message. We had a very simple message in those days. And, of course, when Tommy come to the party, it was still pretty simple too. Mm. Kick it long to Royce and get out of Royce's way.
That though, would have been... And
was a bit later. That was a bit later, yes.
Tell us how you adjusted to the training methods of Tommy Hafey and other players within the club, because whilst the coaching message might have been simple, the training message was pretty ferocious, apparently.
Well, yes, I was at the beginning of the bad, bad era of Richmond and the beginnings of the fantastic era. So, and I was just a very bit player, even though I was lucky to mix it and have great friends like Francis Burke, who I'm here tonight, Wayne Walsh, Barry Richardson, Michael Green, Kevin Bartlett. They're just great people, and I'm lucky to be still great mates with them all. It was just a wonderful era, you know, at that time. And unfortunately, through injuries and a little bit of bad luck, I just didn't get that little bit of extra success that I would have loved, and I would have loved to have played in a grand final, but 67, which is the year I should have played, I ended up getting injured, and I did my hamstring, broke my leg, and so I had three or four fantastic early years, 60 when I started off, and 65 and 66, and then 67, all the bad luck sort of hit me, and 67 and 68, and then Richmond had so much fantastic talent then. Unfortunately, I was on the squeeze, and Collingwood were desperate to get me at that time, but Richmond wouldn't let me go to Collingwood, so I ended up going to North Melbourne. But the training methods of Tommy were just revolutionary at that stage, because I think he just took the hard training to a new level that hadn't happened before in league football. And all of them obviously trained hard, but Tommy just really ground you into the ground and got the best out of you. And, yeah, it was fantastic in that regard.
Now, Frank, I see Kevin Shooter used to call him the white Muhammad Ali. I see Paddy Ganane sometimes at the Victoria Club. He's aged quite well. He's got black hair, which is remarkable. But he used to look like Joe Palooka when he played. He's a huge man, wasn't he? But he's nowhere near that size now.
Amazing now. He's really shrunk, Paddy, like a lot of footballers, put on beef and all that. But Paddy shrunk his muscles. He had muscles on his muscles, and he was just so tough, Paddy. It was amazing.
And can you describe to the listener how this collision occurred, just from A to Z, how it occurred?
Well, it was against Collingwood. We were playing, and there were 90,000 people, and that was some of the crowds back in those days that the home and away games got. I think it was 88 to, you know, it was just an amazing. And I'd just been out injured, and I was coming back, and it was very early in the game, and all I can remember, the ball come over, and there was only I looked down, I was going to run into an open goal. I thought, you beauty, I'm going to kick the first goal here. This is fantastic, you know. Yeah. So I didn't have an opposition player, you know, and I was going to run into an open goal. The ball was coming out. Now, Paddy argues that the ball, I should have got out of his way. He was coming out from goal, right, and he should have got the ball. But I was running into an open goal to kick the goal, and I got wiped out, absolutely knocked. Paddy come and hit me with everything. He still reckons it was the hardest hit he ever got on a football field. And I was just knocked completely unconscious, and I was out to it. And a couple of my teammates, I can remember Mick Irwin and Johnny Northern, who were there, and they thought I was dead. And it was just, you can laugh after it now, and Paddy and I, we still argue. There's always, so we still argue. I still say, well, I was running into the open goal, and he says, you know, that I should have got out of his way, and I said he should have got out of my way. But that's the story, and we're both sticking to it, and we still argue about it to this day.
Yes. Is there any film of it, Frank? I mean, in the winners or something, maybe, you know?
I'd love to see it again. I haven't. I don't know if there is vision of it. It'd be great to pick it up. There was a complete middle page of The Sun had still photos of the big collision. It was one of the great collisions of all time, and they had about 10, the middle page of The Sun on the Monday just had there were about 10 photos of me getting hit by, you know, Paddy's knee and his thing and out to it. It was pretty spooky and scary, and unfortunately a lot of people at Richmond think it was the beginning of my demise, because unfortunately then I was a bit crooked after it for a while, and that year, and then I think that, and it might have been right, I think the selectors, I think then in hindsight, said after that they thought that I changed from being, and I was always, when I say a courageous or reckless, I'm not sure what's the right word, maybe then my ball handling wasn't as clean. Maybe it did affect me more than I thought, or my confidence was lost, and then I had injuries. I'd lost my father early, so I didn't have someone, because really and truly I was going out of league football. I played, I think by the time I was 19, I'd played 42 games, so I hadn't missed a game when I started. And then all of a sudden, you know, as I said, I went backwards from being, on the top of the pile. You know, it doesn't take long in this game. It's such a tough, hard game. And then as soon as something goes wrong, and at that stage, Richmond had fantastic talent. There was no doubt about that. And on the roving side, well, Kevin Bartlett, you didn't need another rover. Francis Burke did some roving. Billy Brown did. Mm. That's right. Billy Brown did the roving at that stage, which was, you know, did well. So it was just unfortunate. I was one of those victims.
It was a team that had plenty of good small man power, and of course with KB on the ball, you spent a fair bit of time in the pocket. In 1966 and 1965, you certainly showed that you had a bit of a nose for goal. There was a bag of five against the Bulldogs, four against the Bombers, four against Fitzroy. Did you like a goal? Because
I did kick a few goals. I have a bit of a... My son Paul played a lot more games than me. He ended up playing 131 or 132, but he didn't kick as many goals as me, so I still have that over him. But yes, I did love a goal, Viney. I think all Rovers love a goal. And yes, I used to be pretty dangerous around goals at the time. And I think in those few years that I did play, I ended up averaging more than a goal a game, I think. So, yes, I always used to get among the goals, usually.
Frank DiMartino, our wonderful special guest tonight. Today it's all drop punts, but back in your day there were a variety of kicks. What was your favourite method of sending the ball through the big sticks?
Usually I was one of the very first, because we did practice it at Richmond with a few of us at the time. And I did use the banana kick back in 1965-66, and I kicked a couple of banana goals in those days, which was very... We had a young fellow that Richmond Blair Campbell, who was a great spin bowler as well, and Kevin and a few of us. We used to all practice with these little ones that they do now too, and I was fortunate to do that. But often we just used the mongrel flat punt. But then I did use the drop punt, and even I did used to use sometimes, but of course we had to get out of that, the stab pass, which the old Thorold Merritt stab pass. Mm. I used to love doing that. And I did play a couple of games with my mate Barry Richardson when I did go back to the second. I had a couple of great games where I think I hit him on the chest about six times in one game with these dropkick stab passes, which we used to, which was very unique. But of course, then we weren't allowed to do those anymore.
You know, you mentioned how you got a bit, you may have been a bit gun shy after that knock, but you played for several more seasons at Richmond North and then Brunswick. So did you have consciously think, about overcoming? Did you say, I've got to drive myself to go in and forget what's going on? I've just got to make sure. You know, did you have a sort of like psycho yourself up? Did you sort of, you know?
I think I worked. I thought I was a bit pissed off. Obviously, you know, which all players are when you get a bit of a heave-ho. And Richmond, much and all as I love the place and still do, when the time comes and when you're not wanted, and the fact that they wouldn't let me go to Collingwood because I probably would have been better at Collingwood at the time, but there was always this thing there with Richmond. So they let me go to North Melbourne. It was always a little bit of a tricky thing. So then I unfortunately got injured at North, and then when I did make the team, because I went there at the beginning of, I'm just trying to remember what year
it was. You were there 69-70.
69-70. In 69, I think I can remember because I was injured pre-season, and really and truly, I reckon I had a great season because when you're damaged goods, I come over and I reckon I played about 8 games in the seconds where I was either best on the ground or equal best before I got a game in the first, because I missed the first few. I was injured, and so I had to really to get back into their ones. And then I played 14 games. I think I played them all in that year. And then Barry Cable came over, and unfortunately I did get another injury which put me back, but then Barry Cable came over, and once again, I had to take a bit of a back seat. And at that stage, now I'm just, you know, sometimes now it's a long time ago, you forget exactly how it happened. But the next year, I was getting myself fit, and I was pretty fit. We had Brian Dixon as the new coach, and there was a mass walkout of North Melbourne players. And if I had known Ron Barassi was coming, I would have stayed at North to have played under Barassi. I would have loved that, and I might have got the best out of me. But because I had a bit of a run-in with Brian, and then North Melbourne at that stage were desperate to get Keith Gregg from Brunswick. Mm. And the only player Brunswick wanted from North Melbourne was me. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of, I prematurely, because I think if you work out, and I'm just not sure now that years, what year that would have been, 70, I was probably only 22 or 23.
23, yep.
Mm. Yeah, so I sort of, I went to the association prematurely. I think I still had league football and I should have in me, and I should have... I should have stayed, but that's the way things work out at the time, you know.
Like Frank Dimitina for Keith Gregg.
Well, almost, yes. And then I did North a favour. Then I trained up a little fella when I went to Brunswick and turned out a pretty good player for North Melbourne called Wayne Schimmelbush.
Now, Frank, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out about that time with Brunswick and also the great pleasure you have derived from watching two boys run around and play league football. And also find out, besides tennis on a Wednesday night, what Frank Dimatina does now. All of that coming up after the break.
On 1116 SEN, evenings with Finey. For Alan Mance, don't lose your pants, call 1-800-ALAN-MANCE.
Well, our special guest tonight is Frank Dimatina, Richmond and North Melbourne in the league, Brunswick, and of course, side a couple of very handy sports people, footballers, and all of that as a backdrop to being one of Melbourne's most famous restaurateurs. Frank, before we leave the league, that time with North Melbourne put you in close proximity to somebody who, he loves a good feed and he was a heck of a footballer, one Sam Kekovich. Do you still catch up with Sam?
I do. I was a great mate of Sam's and, yes, I still catch up with Sam. And he's a good man to come into the restaurant. I've got to get special wines when Sam comes in because he really drinks only the very best nowadays.
So you mentioned Brian Dixon. I remember Brian Dixon made them do this schoolwork and, you know, sit down on the desks and do the study and mark their exams. And the other one was running around the streets and didn't Kekko hide behind a building for a couple of hours and join in it?
Well, there was, I don't know if I upset Brian, because there was one morning he was having these 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30, or, you know, we had to get there at training at Olympic Park. Yeah. And we had Ron Clark then was the fitness coach. And one morning, and we were running, I think I must have still been half asleep, and we'd been running about 3 or 4 4:40s. And Brian bowled me out. He said, "Dimatina, you're not putting in." You know, what are you talking about? I said, "I'll race Clarkey if you like. I'll, you know." Anyway, he said, "Oh, you couldn't beat Clarkey. You know, $20, $20, or, you know." Mm. I said, all right. So this morning at Olympic Park, there's going to be this match race because you might have realised I was a pretty good schoolboy sprinter.
Yeah.
4:40s. I knew Clarkey was a fabulous runner, and if he had been a great tactician, because I'd already done about four. So Clarkey goes out, half the blokes say, "Oh, I want to back them," and some, you know, wanted to back Clarkey. So it gave a bit of fun to the morning. Anyway, Clarkey goes out on the banks and does his warm-up, and so all the players are watching, and boom, off we go in this race. Now, Clarkey, I thought, now this is going to be interesting. What'll I do here? So I just immediately shot out to the front. And then as I got to the front, I just started to ease back and stride because I thought, now, if he had been smart, Ron would have gone whoosh straight past me and made me chase him. But he sat on me, and I thought, beauty, just stay there, Ron. And he stayed there, And then with about 200 to go, I thought, right, hey, now, see if you can catch me. And I took off. So I must have opened up a gap, but I forgot that we'd already done about 3 or 4 4:40. So halfway up the straight, my legs are starting to get heavy and all the boys are screaming out. And, you know, I'd opened up this gap and Ron's starting to cut it back. But anyway, I ended up beating him by about 5 yards. And everyone went mad. And, you know, Dicko had to give me $20. But instead of liking me for it, I think he always had a bit of a grudge against me. he was an interesting character, and there used to be a lot of things that he upset a lot of the players, and there was a mass walkout. But he was, you know, he did his part, and, you know, after he did go, of course, then Ron Barassi, and as I said, if I had have known, but because I was getting a bit of a tough time, and when you've sort of gone from one club, I just sort of, and you're getting on in life. At that stage, we were all working, you know. It wasn't like footballers today where, you know, football's your one thing, where you're working as well, and when you're not getting a game. So when Brunswick and, you know, pushed at North Melbourne, then were desperate to go to Craig, I went. But in hindsight, you know, really and truly, I still had a lot more in me. If I had of, you know, I should have stayed and tried to stay longer in the league ranks. But there were a lot of great players that went out of league football, that went to the country and went elsewhere. After Brunswick, I coached, captain coached Sorrento for 1 year, and I got more in the 1 year that I captain coached Sorrento that I got, I think, in my, you know, 4 or 5 years of league football. So that's how much we used to get in those days, Jeff, as you would remember.
Yeah. And then on to following football, of course, as a father of two league footballers.
Yes.
Paul was, look, he was part of a Bulldogs team, and he formed a ferocious trio of tenacious taggers.
Ramiro, Liberatore and Dimitrino. It was a bit of fun at the time.
Yep.
Yes, that's right. Yep. Yes, they were a nasty type, but they did form a pretty mean group at the time. And yes, I got a lot of enjoyment from watching Paul and then watching Andrew. Andrew was very unlucky, really. He was just starting to, and he still talks very highly of Nick Malthouse, but he had a great year, and then he had worked hard, and he got, unfortunately, every now and then Mick would, one player, one game, he might wipe you on one game, and I thought Andrew was just about to really come into his own, and it was the first game. He did so well to get into the Collingwood team, the first game of the year. Didn't go so well for him, but it wasn't that bad. But Mick put a line through him, and that the rest of that year he was played outstanding football. He was runner-up in the best and fairest at Williamstown, but he never got another look in. But he made league, and he played 28 games, and he did very well. But he was just a little bit unlucky. It's a fine line. We had a few players all around the same, and sometimes you've just got to get that break, or you've got to go elsewhere and you can kick on. But Paul was also, he battled hard. He probably wanted to do it a little bit more because he got delisted from Richmond. He was picked up as a 17-year-old and then delisted, which was very disappointing because he loved the Tigers. And then he had an outstanding year with the Essendon reserves under Kevin Sheedy and on the rookie list. And Kevin was going to draft him with his third draft pick, but the Bulldogs come in with their second. And Paul was disappointed because he loved Essendon then, and he had the Italian group at Essendon that he loved, Steve Alessio and Mark McCurry and Joe Macedi. But who he's still great mates with all those, but then he went to the Bulldogs and he did very well. He was a good battler, and he did reasonably well, Paul. And we used to love watching him. In fact, my wife still barracks for the Bulldogs now.
So between yourself and your boys and other family members, nephew Michael playing football and
Michael cricket.
Playing football and cricket and all of those restaurants.
And your racehorses, Frank.
And racehorses.
Yes, well, my father had a champion racehorse and my brother, and I'm the only one that all the ones I get involved with go a bit slow, but we have had great success with some great racehorses in the family too. Dad had Chiquita many years ago, who won all the Phillies Classics and was second in the Caulfield and Melbourne Cup in the same year. And my brother Don had Naturalism, and the family's had a lot of very good horses over the years. But not so much myself. I mean, all mine go pretty slow, unfortunately.
Well, with all of that sport and entertainment, and of course the restaurant business, etc., I reckon there's something now that isn't a problem that would have been back in the day. And when you say the name Dimitina, most Melburnians would get the spelling pretty well right. It's an ode to the fact that, as I said, the name Dimitina, and it says something about multicultural Melbourne as well, and multicultural Australia, the name Dimitina is more Melbourne than the Yarra River itself. So, Frank, we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Mark. It's been lovely. Thank you, Jeff. It's been lovely to talk to you.
And if you can pass on our thanks to Francis and the other tennis mates.
I'll say that. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Frank.
There you go. Francis Burke, live from Frank Dimitina, live from Francis Burke's tennis court.